I love responsible AI because it includes ethics, but it also includes other table stakes like data privacy, robustness, reliability. So there's a lot of guardrails that go into a solution beyond just thinking about, hey, might this hurt people? And especially in the world of Gen AI, something that we're seeing organizations try to start to prepare for.
Welcome back to the Data Bytes podcast. I have an incredible guest with me here today, Kel Al-Dubai, who is the head of data science at Further and previously the founder and CEO of Panda Data. I've had the pleasure of meeting Kel in person, and if you've been connected with Kel online, you'll already know he has an incredible generosity and personality and is so knowledgeable in this space. But I will tell you, it's even 10 times better when you get to meet him in person and get to hang out with him. His energy is infectious. And I'm so excited to be chatting with Kel today about all things AI, responsible AI, what's new in his life. And so really happy to have you here today, Kel. Welcome to the Data Bytes podcast.
Thanks so much, Sadie. It's great to be here. And for what it's worth, I can't wait till the next time we get to hang out in person.
Yes, we're going to have a ton of fun. So I want to dive right into it because so much is happening in the world of AI. I mean, I think anybody who's in this space feels like we're drinking from a fire hose at times. And one of the things that I see is, which is reasonably so, so many companies are interested in implementing AI solutions. And rightfully so, there's a ton of opportunity that can be taken up in this space. But really, in your experience, what are some of the key indicators that companies overlook when trying to identify an AI opportunity and then measure the success of that AI opportunity?
So I'm going to take a step back and just start with like some of the challenges underpinning that. What I'm seeing is there's this, you know, you have the big four consulting firms that are putting out reports like AI or Gen AI is going to add X trillion dollars to the economy. And there's this almost gold rush mentality and mindset of there has to be value here. And there's so many new ways in which Gen AI can help that it's crowding out the handful of best ways that it can help out. So couple things that we're seeing when it comes to ROI is the value creation, which is the top side of that formula, is constantly being adjusted and reconfigured. And we're seeing folks look at things like how many users are using it, what tasks are they changing with it, to things that are a little bit more direct, like how much revenue was boosted as a result of something. So the top part of the equation is really hard to measure. And then the bottom part, that's the part that's like really driving everyone crazy. Most organizations now are going through kind of an inventorying process. What are we doing that's AI? What's already AI? What are some new tools that we're going to consider as AI? So a lot of spend is getting reclassed, and it's making both sides of this ROI calculation really, really hard to define. So put that on hold for a second. There's a handful of ways that we try to approach, all right, how do you map out the value of something? And it can be, you know, direct. We love it when it's direct. Hey, we've implemented X program and customer retention improved by 10 or 20%. It can be something tangential, like time to resolve. It can be a little bit more indirect. We have a couple of cool projects that we've worked on in the cybersecurity space. So it's like how much risk was avoided or how much information was condensed. But the number one thing that we try to do with clients when we identify a bunch of opportunities is we use the rule of 5%. And we found this to be really, really helpful because it's like, okay, if all we got out of implementing X was a 5% improvement of whatever KPI we've just settled on, would you be excited by that? And if the answer is no, or kind of, it's not to say that that's the only impact that can happen, but chances are you could find something else where you could have disproportionate impact that's worth the investment.
And when you say this 5%, I love this measurement. How long does it take to see that on average? And the reason I ask this question for a little bit of context is when talking with a lot of CDOs, you know, about 2 years into their job, they're starting to see budgets cut because they haven't made the progress that they hope for in time and to show the impact to for the business to be able to reinvest in them. Is it A, they're doing something wrong, or B, we need to have a better expectation of how long some of this change takes, and how long does it take for us to see that increase on either our bottom line or just even our success measurement?
So I had a client recently describe the current AI implementation timelines to be kind of like the big ERP implementation timelines that was taking CIOs forever. And these were multi-year projects. So the time to value depends on a few things. First is, are you building or are you buying? Because if you're going the build route, there's this whole R&D side of things where you're trying to look at, do you even have the right data? You're trying to build the model and figure out, can we build something that's good enough? You've got to implement guardrails from scratch. And I know that's something we'll dive into later. And so there's this long R&D timeline. And the thing with data science is there's so much unknown unknowns and a lot of experimentation. Unlike traditional software development, where you're saying, I'm going to build X, and I know that if I use this assumption, this is what I can expect. There's a lot of, well, I don't know how good the model's going to be until we start looking at it. So that can drag out anywhere from a couple months. I've seen modeling projects take over a year because of all the complexities of what's being built. Then there's the adoption timeline. And this depends a lot on how much change are you introducing to a user's life. Is this something that's kind of slowly behind the scenes or quietly behind the scenes, changing the decisions that are being made or the information that's provided to somebody? Or are you really, truly changing the way somebody is working? And I love to share this one time where we were helping a client reach out to new customers. And our model was supposed to be 30% better. Mathematically, we looked at it, we validated it. And so like, we're like, hey, we're 30% better here at identifying people who are likely to be approved and accepted. And when we rolled it out, our pilot tanked. It was like 10 times worse than humans. And it turns out that the people like that had to make the decisions based on the model didn't trust the AI in the process. And their year-end bonuses were based on how successful selection was. And their like perverse incentives to chase the bonus based on what they knew and trusted ended up tanking the project. And so we'll see something like that silly add a couple extra months to timeline. You have to go through every education process. So in most cases, if you're building, it can be 6 to 12 months to even start to see value, let alone start to accrue those dollars.
Yeah, I think that's such a fantastic example of really what I call kind of like the human machine connection, right? Of like, yes, you can build amazing technical solutions, but again, it still has to be used by humans and one that adds a new interaction component. How do you think we successfully build kind of that integration into our workflows and process, given that it is working with humans? And sometimes, you know, the teams you're implementing your AI solutions with may not have experience with these models, may not trust them, right? And may make different decisions. How do we overcome some of those factors?
So something that we've started to require at the start of any like ML type project or AI type project is we very quickly want to get to the point of failure and understanding what decisions are we implementing. In fact, one of the first red flags that I look for in a project that if somebody says, hey, we want to do X with AI, insert your favorite task. You want to identify more customers. You want to like shorten the time it takes to respond to customer service inquiries, etc. I ask, what are you doing today? How are humans approaching this today? And I'm still somewhat shocked by the amount of times that I get the answer of, well, we're not. AI is going to do that for us. It's like, oh God. Okay, let's take a step back here. If humans aren't doing it, how do you expect AI to do it? So we always try to understand, all right, what's being done today, even if there's no automation, and then try to understand, like, what are the most risk-prone parts of that? What are the most time-consuming parts of it? What are the parts of it that we're hoping to influence? And what decisions, if you know something, would humans be making differently? We had a great example in this with a project with the hospital system looking at readmissions. And it turns out that the vast majority of times that a patient is going to be readmitted or predicted as likely to be readmitted, it's a very complex case. It's a patient that's very sick, very elderly, might be in terminal stages. And what do you do there? Right? There's not a lot that can be done. And so it's all about finding predictions that are actionable and saying, all right, what would it take to change your mind? And identifying what fraction of situations that that's true of. And so we try to understand that first. We try to understand, who are we influencing? What does it take to convince them? What are their barriers to trusting some form of automated system? And we do that at the start of the project, before we even try to get into what data do we have? Is it even suitable? It's what decisions are we influencing?
I think this is such a powerful question, because I see this even within the Gen AI space. You know, I'm such a big proponent of all of my teams using any AI enablement tools. You know, we kind of have a rule, you can purchase and test out whatever you want. And one of the things that I've seen is, as we know with any model, it will always spit something out for you, right? Like, you know, even whether it's a generative model or a descriptive model, which is just telling you yes or no, classification, right or wrong, it will always give you an answer. That's what it's designed to do, right? Whether that answer is right or not, you know, that's all up to how you prompt it or your data input. And I think one of the things that I've seen from the Gen AI space is, it does not overcome people's lack of knowledge in a certain area. Right. So one of the areas that I've seen is, I can still get an input of something out from a team, and I can tell by reading that, yes, you understand it, or no, you didn't, whether you created it or not. Right. And so I think the question that you have of, like, how are you currently doing it, and what do you currently know, and what is your current process, is such a powerful question for any data and AI team, because it will really help them identify what is the starting point and meet your customer where they are, right? Or meet your business partner where they are, which is so powerful.
Like, if you're not doing well at it without AI, chances are you won't do better with it with AI.
Yes, I think, you know, it's again, we have to remember it's a tool. So it's just going to amplify whatever is already there, right? You know, I think it was Sarah Blakely who said, you know, money just amplifies more of who you are. If you're a bad person, you'll become more of a bad person with money. If you're a good person, you'll become more of a good person with money. I'm like, the same is with AI as well, right? So it's just going to amplify your work. So you talked a little bit about, you know, some of the measurements that you do. I think one of the things that, when we look at AI from a human perspective, is really on the responsible AI side of things, but also on that alignment. I know this is a area you've done a lot of work in. What do you think are just baseline principles, like from a first principles thinking? How do we start to think about responsible AI?
I love the definition responsible AI, because it's so encompassing. And I'm glad over the years I've actually seen an evolution in interest in ethics. I still remember vividly being in conversations even a few years ago, where I'd be talking about AI ethics and I'd get, like, responses from individuals saying things like, well, Enron's still in business, so whatever. And, why, you know, it's not like there's laws around this. And today the picture is very different. Like, folks are actually proactively trying to get ahead of bare minimum standards, and trying to think about, all right, what does being ethical actually look like in context of AI? But I love responsible AI because it includes ethics, but it also includes other table stakes like data privacy, robustness, reliability. So there's a lot of guardrails that go into a solution beyond just thinking about, hey, might this hurt people? And especially in the world of Gen AI, something that we're seeing organizations try to start to prepare for is, well, if we want to attach a bunch of these language model driven solutions to our repository of content, we have to get really, really good at governing our content. We need to know what contains sensitive information. We need to know who has permission to access that information. And this is kicking off a lot of more robust deep dives into governance. So that's like table stakes. That's a big part of responsible AI and just need to have if you're going to do anything with generative. On the ethical side, one of the things that plagues AI projects in my experience isn't individuals with malice, although that exists. I think that's a much smaller problem than unintended consequences. And the things with models, like you said earlier, they're designed to give a response. They're not designed to say, whoa, I don't know. And when you key in on certain patterns and scale that up, if those patterns are flawed or contain flawed assumptions, you know, at best you're talking about really bad performance, like the model's not behaving in the way you expect. And at worst, you could be doing things like in a readmissions model, over-selecting people from, you know, white males, for example, over other individuals who get extra priority in terms of like whose attention is going to them.
Yeah, well, this reminds me a lot of one of the research papers I studied in child psychology, which is they found that young kids sometimes actually aren't aware that they're lying. They are just programmed to say an answer, even if they don't know, right, or remember what they did. And so sometimes they'll just spit something out because they're like this, yeah, and they're not even actually – one, they're not self-aware at a really young age. Two, they don't have a good remembrance of time. And so we may punish them or think that they're lying when they were just spitting out an answer. And it reminds me of a lot of where we're at with some of these models is they're so programmed, as you mentioned, to just spit out an answer. I'm really excited about some of the work that's being done in having the models pause and think. I just read a research paper from Stanford today, which talked about giving AI models an internal dialogue to give them an opportunity to, you know, pause before you speak, right? Which I think is something we all could do a little bit more of too, even as humans, and know that it works a lot better when we take a second to take a deep breath, take a pause, think about what you're saying before you just spit things out. And so I'm wondering how, besides giving these models the opportunity to pause, do you see any other types of solutions to overcoming the problem that we have, which is just output, 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 when we want to balance output with what is true and right and ethical and responsible?
So one of the things that we try to do here is build up intuition, data sense, if you will. I'm trying to find a better word for it. But whenever data scientists get together and talk, we get that like, oh, wow, we're looking at this data set. And let's say we're trying to model readmissions because it's something we've talked about already today. Only 30% of our data set is female. And oh, 80% of the population is coming from this part of the country that's more likely to have individuals who are Hispanic. Okay, well, that doesn't look like the rest of the country. Let's figure out how we balance this data set. We almost kind of intuitively know that if we train a model on this, it won't generalize to other places, even if it's okay in that context. Most individuals don't have that, and most individuals don't know the ways in which models pick up on patterns. So I love to use a couple of examples, but I'll put up a slide deck and I have a bunch of squirrels on grass and a bunch of cats in indoor settings. And I'm like, all right, what does the AI learn is the difference here? And it turns out grass is the easiest way, right? It looks for the easiest way to differentiate between two things. So it sees patterns in different ways than us. And then on the flip side, there's a study that happened over at MIT a couple years ago, where they looked at computer vision applied to medical images. And they found that models could learn to identify self-reported race, even though trained radiologists couldn't identify self-reported race from those images. And so there's patterns we can't even see that the models pick up on. And I'm a big fan of doing AI literacy training, helping more individuals involved in the process outside of data scientists, who might be involved in curating the data or suggesting the ideas, or evaluating the performance of these models, or even taking action on them. Get trained up in AI literacy so that we can avoid some of these unintended consequences, or have more folks raising their hand and saying, oh, might there be a problem here?
Yes, I definitely think the awareness and education is the answer in so many of these instances, as it really allows us to, one, bring more people into the conversation. And now is the time to bring more people into the conversation, because AI is not for the people working in the space building the models. AI is for all of us, right? And so making sure that we have everybody in the conversation is essential. I want to shift gears just a little bit. So you are the founder and CEO of Panda Data, which just recently got acquired. Congratulations. Tell me a little bit more about your journey to becoming a founder, the team you've built, the work you've done, and kind of what's next in the next stage of your career.
So I'm still like on cloud nine. This just happened, and I'm 5 days into being head of AI and data science. So there's a lot of learning ahead of me. But I started Pandata in 2016 when I was in my last year of undergrad. And a fun aside there, I had changed my major 7 times, one for each year as an undergrad. So that gave my family a lot of grief. I took a couple of years where I was part-time to work on my startups. And I kept hearing over and over again, we have data, we don't know what to do with it. I was working in healthcare research at the time, looking at things like what keeps a healthy population healthy, how do you reduce the burden of cost in a workplace. And I realized I was doing data science in like 2013, 2014. And that's what led me to start Pandata. I wanted to create a practice where individuals could, you know, learn how to more effectively solve problems with data. And this was back in 2016. And for context in the time, I was based in Cleveland, still am, but in the whole Northeast Ohio region, I did a LinkedIn search. And I was looking for every person who had data in their title. There were 150 individuals in that whole region with a data science background. There were fewer than 10,000 in North America also at the time, which is crazy to think about. And like, we were a microcosm of what was happening, because most of the talent was either East Coast or West Coast. And most of the individuals in my area worked for one of 3 companies. So that's what inspired me to start Pandata. And first it was all things data. And it's crazy. Tableau was new at that time. Power BI was new at that time. And over the years, we progressed and evolved, and we started to focus on machine learning. And then I saw a growing pain point. As data science became more democratized, high-risk industries like healthcare, financial services, energy, they had a harder time building models. They needed more help. There were more considerations, especially because these are places where you had to be careful, even before restrictions like the EU AI Act, about how might you unintentionally harm individuals, how do you deal with data privacy and security, and that ultimately became Pandata's focus.
I have a lot of things that I'm impressed by your story, and I think a couple of things to relate to as well. I know when I entered the field of data science in 2014, people ask how I picked my master's program. I'm like, well, there were 5, so it was very easy to choose from, right? It was a whole different world at that time, and it's been incredible to watch the industry grow. And I completely agree with you regarding, you know, the difficulty to implement some of these solutions in what I would call highly regulated areas, such as like healthcare and finance. Before, I always thought that these companies move slower because they were older, they're older institutions. But I've come to find out that a lot of times it's really because of the regulation and a keen sense of risk and a way to mitigate that risk. And so I'm curious, how did you overcome and find this niche into more of these kind of highly regulated industries and then just areas that people weren't tapping into as much. Was this a way that you built that to be your niche because no one was in it, or was no one in it because it required a lot more education and awareness to get people on board and feel that trust?
So in a funny way, I think part of the reason how I ended up there is because I was stubborn enough to end up there. Actually, it's funny. It would take me sometimes 2 to 3 years to actually go from first conversation to working with one of the hospitals that we ended up working with, which is really common in the space. And it's very easy to lose interest, especially when there were much more like freely flowing budgets and things like marketing, and sales, etc. I was also very deeply disturbed by rising costs in healthcare. And I would see the way things are done. And I'm like, oh my gosh, there is so much room to add efficiency here. Even little things can add efficiency here. So it's a combination of there wasn't enough talent embedded in healthcare at that time. In fact, data scientists working in-house at hospitals was just not a thing up until a few years ago. Mainly because data scientists would leave because they couldn't get to deploy models in production. That's actually one of the leading causes of churn in our field. So it was a couple of things. They couldn't get access to talent. Vendors and solution providers had to go through so much diligence and stress testing and compliance that many folks didn't think it was worth it. There are people doing this, just a lot, not a lot. And I saw a market opportunity there. And after working with a few healthcare-related tech companies and hospitals and biotech companies, we built up enough of a portfolio to continue going after that market. And I found the work to be just deeply rewarding. As far as how we dealt with the risks, that was a lot of like learning on the job. It starts with, okay, what are unintended consequences that could happen here? And as different standards emerged, we started to get inspired by that. But it really just started with us understanding the data side of things and then bridging the gap with the clients, understanding what does this look like to a customer, to an end user, as far as your policy is concerned.
So tell me more about this grit and tenacity you have, because, you know, what I can only imagine how hard it is starting a company right outside of college, or while you were actually in college still, let alone just being a founder myself. I know how much grit and tenacity you need when doing anything or starting anything new. Where do you refuel that tenacity, and how did you keep going in some of the low times and hard times? Because I think right now it's easy, you know, you're well known, people talk to you, they see your company just got acquired, but there was, what, 10 years prior to this that it was hard, right? That people didn't notice, that people weren't, you know, you weren't on podcasts talking about all your success. You were, I'm guessing, trying to get a client. Like, what kept you going during those times?
Let me set the stage. I think one of the many rock bottoms I hit was the start of Pandata. I had actually a startup before this that was working on personalized medicine and healthcare and on healthcare data. And I raised about $250,000, didn't get too far in that beyond the seed stage, poor product market fit, inexperienced entrepreneur, but I had failed that. I'd left a full ride scholarship to start that. I was entering my 7th year as an undergraduate. I did not have a degree. And I lost my scholarship and I had to go take out loans to finish my education. And I call my dad and I say, "Dad, they just launched a data science program at Case. I want to change my major." If I were him, major number seven. And it was my like 6th year. And he goes, "Just duck your head and graduate." And it's so funny. Like in that moment, I could totally see his point of view. And I saw it too. I'm like, wow, I'm a real loser right now. But what kept me going is the excitement for the field. I have, since day one as a data scientist, fell in love with this idea of patterns and humans represented in patterns. And as I started to understand more about unintended consequences and the risk reward of, hey, we can help people, but this can also unintentionally hurt others. And how do we balance both of these needs, and understanding that it's not a cut and dry solution, I just really love this problem space. And as somebody who's a dual citizen, having grown up in Saudi Arabia and then also lived in America, American mom, Saudi dad, there's a lot of what I call gray space in cultural norms where neither one's right, neither one's wrong. And I see that, and there's some really special ways in which you have to handle those situations. And I see a lot of that in the world of data science. So that's kept me going. And just for the past few years, getting to meet so many other data scientists who have been doing this for as long or longer, who are now doing things like you and some of our other friends in the data science community with their own podcasts and communities. That's the part that really like keeps me showing up.
Thank you so much for sharing just a little bit of the low points, because one of the things that I think is difficult with social media is we don't see people's complete and full journey, right? To know that there's no such thing as an instant success, right? And I think more importantly, just speaks to how important it is to really find your passion. And I know it can sound so cliche, but the truth is, it's going to be hard, and it's going to be, as you mentioned, your passion that's going to carry it through. And so if you don't have that passion, you're probably going to quit. And that's not a bad thing, because if you quit, maybe it's leading you to that next thing that will find your passion. I mean, you change majors 7 times. So if that doesn't give anyone some hope, you know, I don't know what will. So tell me a little bit about what's next. You just joined Further as the head of AI and data science. What are you going to be building there? And what are you excited about? What are you passionate about these days?
Oh my gosh. I have this new infusion of energy in me about this opportunity. So I met Mike Gustafson from Further. I want to say like September, so less than 6 months ago. It's crazy how fast this came together. And they had just rebranded as Further, and they're a privacy first data analytics AI practice. And the amount of alignment between what they do and what we do is insane. For a little bit of context, Pandata got to a little over 1.3 million in annual revenue, completely bootstrapped. We'd worked with 50 some clients on machine learning and AI projects over the 8-year history that I had the business. Further has like orders of magnitude more, and they've served more than 100 of the Fortune 500. And they're very eager to double down on, and in a lot of these high risk areas, and they're very eager to double down on providing privacy first, secure machine learning and AI solutions. So from a scaling perspective, I'm really excited about that. But while we were talking about this potential acquisition, one of the ideas I floated is, hey, I see AI regulation starting to mature. The EU AI Act at that time was still being finalized, and it had just passed its final vote, I think a couple weeks ago. And I said, could we build an AI auditing practice in addition to everything else that we're doing with machine learning and AI? And they said, go for it. So I'm really excited to dig into what that means. But my vision for the future, what I'm seeing is, just like we have SOC 2 audits for sensitive and secure data sets, we're gonna have very standardized AI audits. And that's something that you're not gonna be able to self-attest. It's gonna be something where you need a partner to come in, guide you through a series of questions, you partner together, you vet it, you submit it to a regulatory authority, and that's going to help keep folks safe, keep these AI systems safe. And it's not going to get in the way of innovation, but it's going to create a new market opportunity to kind of streamline and deliver these services. So I'm excited to get to build out one of the first of these practices.
Yeah, and I'm really excited for this because you're the first that I've heard who's building out this practice. And I think it's so neat. I mean, we've seen it with the EU AI Regulation Act. We also saw it with the executive AI order from the US government in regards to, hey, we're not going to audit every model, but we know that some models will need audited. And so, you know, just as we have large consulting firms like Deloitte and EY who do a lot of this auditing today, we need to have specialized firms to be able to do some of this auditing within the AI and data science space. So really excited for what you're doing at Further and continuing to see the team grow and continuing to see you live out your passion. So excited for what's next.
Me too. And, you know, I can't end this conversation without saying that you know, six amazing humans have made the transition from Pandata over to Further. And we have some amazing talent growth plans. We've already put out our very first job offering on like day two of me starting. So we're always looking for AI strategy folks, and we'll be posting at least four new jobs in the next few months, and a lot of plan to grow from there.
Amazing. Well, we'll definitely include a link in the show notes to everybody listening so they can go check that out. Cal, before we wrap up today, any last piece of words of wisdom or advice or even fun facts that you like to share with our audience before we close?
So my fun fact is that I'm on a mission to see 100 countries in my lifetime. I'm at 30 out of 100. And I see that as essential for my own understanding of what we've described earlier as like the gray space. The more time one can spend immersed in cultures so totally different from their own changes the way they think, changes the way they recognize the assumptions that they might have. And I think this ties beautifully into our whole conversation and theme of if you want to build AI well or use AI well, you really need to start to understand the assumptions that go into what we define or choose to define as correct. So travel can actually be a great two birds with one stone, have fun, and make you a better AI human.
Completely agree. I think, you know, just as we've talked about, you have to have more data in your model, and us as humans need the same thing. So we need more experience, more exposure. And I think it's really going to be what helps create better understanding and empathy and compassion for each of us as we get to meet other people and cultures. And I'm excited to watch you on your journey and also to see you reach the 100 countries. So thank you for taking the time to come in and talk to us with this exclusive Data Bytes interview on the update on acquisition, but more importantly, just to come in and share your wisdom and knowledge and experience. And thank you for everything that you've done to contribute to this space and be a thought leader. So appreciate you.
Thanks, Sadie. It's been good to be here.
All right. Thanks, everybody. Remember to stay curious and keep learning, and we'll catch you next time on the Data Bytes podcast. Bye-bye. If you are enjoying the conversations you are hearing today, we encourage you to continue to be a part of the conversation and join a community of like-minded, extraordinary women. With our free community membership, you're stepping into a realm where learning, networking, and growth are at the heart and soul of what we do. Connect with Women in Data's global community and network with our chapters all for free. But why stop there? Upgrade your membership with a special offer for Data Bytes listeners by getting $20 off a pro membership, in which you'll receive access to over 300 classes, leadership training, and exclusive events. If you're interested in mentorship and networking, we've got you. From monthly thought leadership webinars to exclusive networking events and a diverse on-demand mentorship program, the connections you'll make here are boundless. Join us and be part of a vibrant network. Dive into our book clubs, growth groups, and industry-focused gatherings. Women in Data is not just a community. It's a movement, a place where innovators, changemakers, and leaders come together to shape the future. Visit womenindata.org to join or use the special discount code in the show notes. Together, let's drive change one data byte at a time.